what's been on my mind a lot lately is the difficulty of building a financial model for a private equity investment that doesn't adopt traditional means, you know, which is an absolute necessity, you know, because of the last, you know, 3 to 5 years, everyone had been on the larger scale films. Private equity had been asking for you to run kind of your own models of profit and loss and where things would be. And if you put zero in for a U.S. acquisition or any of the numbers you hear, the model just doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And the other part of that that people never talk about is what has been a huge decline on foreign pre-sale or foreign acquisition prices, too. So the question that I have, like, you know, to me, there's no shortage of good ideas of things that can make it better. I was recently asked to speak in front of a group of investors and come up with an indie film infrastructure reboot, and I, in the course of like 2 hours, wrote up, you know, 36 micro businesses that I thought would all, you know, generate a return and working together create something. And I showed it to them and said, Ted, you can't put 36 down. They'll think you're absolutely, you know, absolutely insane. You limit it to 20. So it was like, yeah, okay, you can limit it at 20. And but still, like, the problem, each of those little steps, which are just about kind of facilitating, you know, how do you get people to me, like, the core thing is, how do you get people to be able to share their passion for film in a more rich way? You know, right now, there's no way they can show that this has been proven and this works. And until people start to take the chance and be willing to step out there and maybe not fail, you're not going to even build, and maybe fail, you're not going to be able to build the model. So the question that I feel is, like, how do you find the quality of films who are willing to take all of the small steps and do all of the hard work, which is always the resistance of filmmakers? You know, like, will I do this 2 years, 3 years, and still be able to you know, get my next movie made, but kind of recognize that that's their responsibility for all of us if we want to keep making movies? Because, as I said, I look at it and say, you know, I don't have a way to make a living, you know, to do this anymore. And I sit in the most privileged seat, you know, one of the most privileged seats, so I get my movies made. And, you know, that is wearing out. That's a slow drip and trickle. So I get excited by the work that everyone else is doing and hope to join in.
All right. And once everyone's done kind of going around, we can
I think that probably the thing that excites me most, or what I've been thinking about most, is really, I feel like in some ways, and I've talked about this before, that the traditional process is holding things back, you know, and that's from the standpoint of filmmakers thinking about the way that they create their work and their relationship, which, you know, I think audience is actually a poor name for it, you know. I think it's like that ability to move it more towards the community, and in some ways I think it's ironic, because I think the audience knows in some ways what they want. It's just it hasn't been turned on yet, you know, it hasn't been switched over. You know, they want something that's frictionless, but then they want a way to meet each other, and they want a way to kind of be able to interact. And so I found myself really kind of compelled by some of these models of piracy, you know, like, why does piracy, why is it rampant, what is it? Well, it's because it's frictionless, it's because it's easy, you know. And are there certain things within that mechanism of delivery and certain things in that, you know, that culture? Because if we jump ahead and we say, you know, okay, a film is really going to become similar to music, if it goes a similar path, it's been doing that, as you know from your book, Scott, you know, since, you know, Edison, all the way through, you know, audio's been a little bit ahead. So if you look at that and you say, okay, well, if the album isn't necessarily, if that's a loss leader and it's all about the other experiences, then, you know, how do you tap that? How do you make that valuable for film, you know, or, you know, the media, or media in general? So I find myself very interested in those aspects and kind of looking and saying, okay, well, you know, and myself is just naturally drawn towards cross-media, transmedia, saying, okay, well, if there's an expansion of this, it's naturally going to come from these other, you know, media franchises. So I'm very interested in that dynamic of that tipping point. And then real practical kind of things, you know, moving from the theoretical into the tangible.
Well, I was going to say, like, on a practical point, just do a minute on kind of, is there a business model that you see for if people pirate your film or pirate your music, how does the creator get paid?
Okay. Well, I mean, the should I speak to something that exists currently or is emerging?
Something you think might exist, you know, might emerge soon.
Well, Jamie King's doing a model called Voto, which is voluntary donation, and what they do is they throw up, he's been going to, like, the largest tracker sites, you know, Pirate Bay, Mini Nova, ISO Hunt, all these different places, and basically, it's really simple. I mean, it's just worked out a deal with them where they'll ride a banner across their site, and then what they do is they just put up a donation thing. So whether you did it with somebody like Voto, what he's trying to do, or you just did it on your own, it's like a donation volunteer thing. I mean, that's one particular model towards that, but I think the model that would really kind of unleash that is the ability to start to pass and have some of the universal license quality to that. So if somebody goes and takes that and is able to say, oh, you know what, now I'm vested in this project in some particular way, like as an individual, you know, so I become a distribution hub for it, a marketing hub for it, whatever it is, whatever I want to do. I make t-shirts, I license this element from you and say, I'm gonna take it and I'm gonna use that graphical image and I'm gonna make these t-shirts if it's in the analog world. And then there's a residual that passes back, you know, things along those lines. So I think, to me, that model kind of goes into cross-media, but then also takes on some of the delivery mechanism of torrents, which are really good, and then the idea of community. So I think somewhere in there, I don't think it's just voluntary donations. I think it's that ability to turn on that engine and say, okay, here are the mechanisms that you can use.
But how, even kind of trying to address it, even saying it's a super low-budget film, it's still a $200,000 investment, you know, the fear factor of getting a return is any more that people can move off, can, you know.
Maybe I should pass it because
Let's keep going and come back to that, because I want to talk more about that, too.
And the kind of things I've heard, I don't think any of the film business, any of the things I've listened to, no one's got any answers whatsoever. The kind of players who are on the panels, and it's kind of, you know, the same things the last couple of years, I think. You know, there are a few more platforms, you know, hundreds more platforms, but nobody's talking about revenues. And in a way, that's the thing that I find a bit miserable, but the thing that I'm really excited about is this idea of cross-media and the potential for it, for film. And it's kind of like what Lance was saying. I think the kind of the key things that filmmakers have got to think about are their projects and audiences. And all the kind of bits in between, in a way, kind of can fit together and they can use them, but those are the kind of key things to focus on. And once you start doing that, stories... Hi. Hi. Thinking about the story you're telling, kind of all kind of possibilities start happening, and you don't start getting confined in this idea of a 90-minute feature and how the hell you're going to monetize it in a kind of way you always did. It's this kind of format that exists in one kind of space, okay? It all just moves from space to space in a window, you know, like moves from theatre to whatever to whatever, whatever, and you kind of obsess on the windows thing. Once you start thinking about story, the kind of possibilities are kind of endless. So this idea of franchise, whatever you call it, or sort of like story or intellectual property that can expand for as long as you like. And it's what Lance has been doing with Head Trauma, in a way. You've created a film that's just continued, a story that's continued and gone out in so many different ways. That, you know, and creatively, I guess it's been really exciting for you. And also, you found all kinds of ways of monetizing it and building community. And I think once you start getting out of the boundary of these kind of scripts that sit in kind of 90 minutes, 120 minutes, whatever, all kinds of possibilities are there. And then all the different partners that you could possibly bring into projects are immense. So that's what we were kind of trying to do with Pass Pixel, was think, well, you know, sales agents, just territorial distributors, they don't have any money, they're not spending any money, they're not taking any risks. Do you want to get them involved? Is it relevant? Once you start sort of thinking, okay, well, who else is out there? There are a whole lot of other different companies and businesses that could be interested in stories. And so, for example, I know everyone started talking about media agencies and brands and how you kind of build those in, and there are really exciting ways, I think, that you can do that without sort of reversing to very crass sort of product placement type things. Because brands have exactly the same issue as kind of the movie business in a way. They're trying to look for consumers, and they're very smart at how they do that. So there's kind of interesting relationships there. And there aren't many, you know, we don't have that many kind of great examples yet, but one I think is a very interesting example is Summer's Town, that a British filmmaker called Shane Meadows made, and it was it's a film, he makes very kind of like grassroots films. They're quite grungy, they're really about sort of like elements of kind of working class British life, and some of them quite retro. This one was set in a housing estate, in a housing scheme just by the station, St Pancras, where you take the train to the continent, to Paris. We're at the Eurostar, and it was actually Eurostar who financed the whole movie. And if you look at the movie, it's black and white, it's got nothing,
100% has its integrity.
Yeah, it's got nothing the brand has stamped on it. And the last film that I remember Eurostar being associated with was The Da Vinci Code, and I remember the whole thing, they came down to Cannes and the Eurostar, like, they decked out this thing, and that's a kind of interesting example. It's not an interesting kind of example of community building in a new way, sort of online or whatever, but I think if you'd added that, and that's what the agency was sort of saying, you actually, the agency with a producer, the media agency who are representing Eurostar, it's an agency called Mother, they realised afterwards, if they combined some of those kind of interesting ways of building sort of community and doing new things with different platforms, and it could have kind of gone further even. But it was a great example. But it's the integrity, I think, of the story that's really important. So there's that, there's, you know, there's all the TV companies, the multi-platform commissioners, the tech companies, anyone who's kind of moving into the space, I think is, who are trying to somehow build new business models and bring story and build their audiences and consumers, there's all kinds of possibilities there. So.
I guess I've sort of been obsessing over this metadata project a little bit.
I've been working on that, so it's kind of just in my head all the time. I've just took on this tiny task of trying to align the entire industry around one common metadata format. But that'll be done in another 3 or 4 months, so that'll be fine. Yeah, I'm working on it. Next week, I'll have it ready. But, I mean, that's kind of a short-term thing that I hope will kind of be ready, and then we'll go and we'll move on. But more long-term and more interestingly, I'm thinking about the idea of this kind of technology S-curve trend, which is, this idea that just generation after generation throughout history, you have some kind of major technology, any kind of major technology kind of starts off, and if you have this graph of, like, time and, like, I guess just sort of general value or usability, that things kind of, you start off growing very, very slowly, and things are, like, expensive and they stink, and then they kind of take this up curve and they go pretty much sharply up for, like, however long, and then they sort of level off, right? The example is, like, sort of as film kind of, you know, it takes, like, a few years before you can have a decent picture in a film, and then it sort of goes up and better and better and better, and then in the end it's kind of like, well, it's just the same all the time. And then you have the next S-curve that kind of overlaps to that is, like, digital photography, for example, which sort of starts off pretty awful, and then it goes up and up and up. And I think what we're seeing in the film industry is that our S-curve has flattened out and it's run out before the next S-curve has taken over. I think that our problem here is that there's no overlap. Usually I think you have the next one in place before the previous one runs out. And I feel like that's a result of some cultural issues in the film industry. I think between just being dominated by these massive corporations that have a lot to lose and sort of love their control, and what we were talking about before of this, the kind of tyranny of discretion, you know, of not being able to, like, say, hey, I think this stinks, you know, or I think, you know, I don't like what that guy's doing, or this contract sucks, and I think, you know, you get these, and also kind of the idea of the myth of, like, I'm going to make my film and somebody's going to swoop in with $8 million at Sundance and, like, you know, sort of bless me and, you know, and then I have a career, you know? So...
And not have to worry about anyone else.
Exactly, you know? So I think what's needed is sort of a kind of cultural shift. I mean, what I would like to see is, I'd like to see the film industry sort of be more like the technology industry, which is, it drives me nuts, because, I mean, we're all supposed to be creative people, you know, and if you say, okay, put any of us on set, and you say, okay, you know, there's a truck in the way, or, like, the actor didn't show up, or something, and, you know, I'm able to, like, okay, we're going to rethink this, shoot the scene in a different way, and it's way better than it ever was before. But to do that in, you know, a business model, or, you know, we can't do that. It's got to go exactly the way I was told that it had to be growing up. So, you know, I've been thinking about kind of like what you guys said about now is a good time to just try a million different things. You know, really just throw everything against the wall and see what sticks. And try to learn from it and see what comes out of it. And, you know, I think if we can just make, like, a ton of small projects and really get rid of the assumptions of, like, the idea of, you know, it's kind of like a lot of what you wrote about in your book, how, you know, why is a film the length that it is? Why is a TV show the length that it is? And it's because of these kind of old idea restrictions that are either technical or, you know, or corporate or business models that just are completely obsolete,
yeah.
Right? And say, all right, let's. Many of them are. And
but also, I think there is a psychological link to like a 90-2 hour.
Sure. And there, you know, there is some of that. And right. And I think that will, some of that will continue. You know, I mean, there is a place right now for black and white photography. Fine. But not everything has to be black and white photography. So, I think there's sort of two ways that this can happen. You know, one, we can say, okay, you know, let's keep trying this until we have another Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and somebody, you know, maybe somebody at this table, maybe somebody who's like, you know, some 18-year-old kid out there somewhere will do something that'll be completely strange and transmedia, and then they'll make a bajillion dollars at it, and everybody say, okay, let's copy that, right? Or, and I think that's what kind of happens generation to generation in the film business. But I think if we can kind of try for sort of just the more cultural thing, because I think people are always asking, like, okay, what are the steps? What is the recipe to follow? And I was watching a talk by this guy, James Spool, the other day. Brilliant. And he was talking about how he goes into these companies and he does this research, and he's found that companies that have these methodologies, these recipes, they don't really do so well, because they say, okay, if something doesn't work, they go, all right, well, let's revise the steps and the recipes. But the companies that do really well are the ones that say, okay, here's a sort of bag of tricks that you can, some shortcuts we can learn, and we can kind of keep that in our company's knowledge, and then they set up a culture, you know, and the culture says, look, gives you a general idea of how to kind of make decisions going forward. So what I'd like to say is people saying, okay, here's a bunch of tricks we can learn, you know, from what you did on your movie and what you did on your movie, but let's push for a culture of innovation. You know, let's take that problem solving on set and bring it out into, you know, the business, because that is part of the art. You know, we're filmmakers. We should be proud of our problem solving and creativity.
Right. And it also has to be a culture of information sharing, which people
yes.
are still, even in the world of blogs, are still really timid about saying, you know, here's how much I made from all these different channels,
right.
Here's how much it cost me to produce the Blu-ray DVD of my
right.
film, and you know.
Right, that's the sort of bag of tricks.
Yeah.
You know.
So just, let's try to condense the time a little bit.
Okay.
Someone said they had to, yeah, right, you said you had to leave around 10:45.
Well, not to be sort of an undying Pollyanna, but I think we're at this really awesome moment right now, actually, in independent film, where some of the barriers have broken down and audiences feel more empowered, you know, as we've all been talking about, to sort of take in content and make it theirs. And I think that can create problems, especially financially, because the old structures of, like, gates in front of a movie are breaking, you know, swinging wide open. But I also think that is creating an enormous potential. And I talk to several filmmakers a day, and the information sharing is completely there and completely open and completely collegial. And everybody talks about what they're doing and what they're trying. And audiences are very involved in that. And I operate completely outside of the traditional corporate world. But with some of the the traditional model still in place. It's the sort of traditional conventional idea that you license something, that you pay for something, and then you get that content in return is still operating, but in this sort of more flexible, communal, community-oriented, cooperative way. And it reminds me, it's exciting to me because it sort of reminds me of a few weeks ago there was an article in the New Yorker by Atul Gawande about healthcare reform, and he was saying we don't have to reinvent the wheel, we don't have to scrap everything and start fresh with this new innovative idea. That, and he uses all these examples of other, you know, sort of technological and social developments over time. And he says we can jerry-rig it. The best comes out of that, actually out of a jerry-rigged system. And I think that that's what we have now. We have sort of the old model is still in place, but it's breaking down. New models are rising up. Some people are trying to scrap the old and totally replace it with the new. And I think everything goes. See, like, we're in this moment now where everything goes. And in my daily life, working with filmmakers, it's incredibly exciting. I mean, people are paying to watch their film in a sort of traditional community, communal setting, very theatrically, cinematically. Mm-hmm. But they're also, those doors have broken down, those sort of traditional doors. A lot of people are seeing the film, individuals are seeing a film for free, but they're sort of seeing it in the old model. So there's like a mix of the old and the new, and the filmmaker is making money. The filmmaker is, or in many cases, earning back the money that they already invested in their project. And it's really nice because you're sort of building on these old-fashioned structures of community togetherness, while still injecting a new model of freedom of information and, you know, just freedom of viewing, freedom of the communal experience.
So.
It's different for documentaries. I think that narrative films can also have that if they're sort of very, if there is a certain, if they're circumscribed in a certain way. You know, if there is sort of a targeted message that really reaches to specific audiences.
That's hard.
And that is hard. Yeah, in a narrative. Yeah, yeah. I don't think that that's necessarily a limitation. I mean, I think that as this becomes more widespread with documentaries, I think it will open up the door for narrative. And I think it's a rare instance, actually, in which documentary is paving a distribution path that the narrative can follow on, rather than the other way around. I don't know. I'm maybe too optimistic, but I think what I see is working, and it's really
working
great.
For you.
Yeah.
So I guess. It's interesting because obviously everything that you guys are talking about, we're trying to kind of take action on right now. And two things that what Lance was saying was, okay, how do you do what piracy does in terms of getting the easy part is making sure a million people see it. I get if you follow the piracy approach, but the hard part is voluntary donation. That seems like actually the ultimate friction to me. We had this experience with our theatrical distribution in Canada. It's like great press. How do you like turn that into, you know, the bums in seats model, which is sort of like, it feels almost, it's weird to be thinking about actually. But so I think that can be one approach to what we're doing. We're going to try and have a central point where people can do the pay what you can. I think is an interesting twist on the voluntary donation. But the other part is this whole idea of the universal license. So our film is released under a Creative Commons license, but how do we indicate with that there is a preferred model that we would, a preferred method that we would like you to use to pay. And that's the CC Plus. And it hasn't really gotten a lot of traction right now, and we're actually hoping that with the film, we can kind of be one of the only people that actually implements it and says, here's the third party so you can share it, you can remix it for non-commercial purposes. That's not new. What would be new is the plus, which says, here's if you want to get involved with this financially, here's how to do it. First of all, TV's out of the question. You can't go and sell this to a television network. You can't do it. The rights are all gone, and anyway, I just don't want you to do that. I need to be able to do that. Second payment is, as a consumer, how do you pay? Here's the URL. Go for it right there. If you want to do DVD, here's this market, this market, this market, this market. Here are all of our economic engines for this work. If you are watching this film and you want to respect my wishes and adhere to my Creative Commons license, you're supposed to do this.
Well, so like if I wanted to subtitle it for Indonesia and distribute it there and you hadn't sold those rights, you're saying, all right, here's the deal, it's a 50-50 split of any revenues that you make.
If you want to do that, then great. Subtitle it in Indonesia. Here's my email address, and we'll work it all out.
And does that, does it get like an exclusive license, or is that like, can you have 10 different people in it trying to distribute in Indonesia?
That's a good question. But
and what happens if it gets subtitled, you know, and the quality is not your liking, or has a different level of...
But the translation is terrible.
So this is the other thing, right, is the idea of that Liz was talking about, how do you make multiple, and Lance does this all the time as well, how do you make multiple versions, basically, of your work?
Well, I talked about this with Aaron about when we were trying to figure out something like this, and say, like, okay, let's just stick this thing on the film and send it out. And there were a couple of problems with it. You had, one was that, like, so he was like, all right, well, here's the deal. You say, you can sell it. But you have to give like 50% back, right?
Okay,
so we can
take it around the table.
The final point with that is this idea of the remixable film. Like, we're showing a different version at Ann Arbor next week than we showed on Sunday. So that gives us the opportunity to... We tried to get around a lot of this premiere bullshit with that. A lot of the film festivals wouldn't take it, but some of them would. And they said, oh, well, that's interesting for us. That's actually, okay, so I don't have the U.S. premiere, but I have the first remix version at the other premiere. And so if Conservative Dickwad Festival of South Carolina wants to play the Attack remix version, give her. You know, the idea is that they'll always be able to track it back to me because I've been working on it for 6 years. Everyone knows that it's the Attack ad version of Remix Manifesto, and that's good. And if they don't want to be pirates, like they say I am, they'll respect my CC license and pay me.
That's what universal censorship is.
What's that?
Universal censorship. And universal.
But it's not censorship.
No, I know.
Okay, well, just to, it's a broad question of what I'm thinking about at South by Southwest. This is the third year I've been at South by. It's the first year I've walked down that very, 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 very long hallway and taken a left and walked down that other very, very, very long hallway to the interactive part and not stopped at the gaming section. And I did that. I walked in. I took a left into the big room, and there were like 1,000 people listening to this wine guy who has apparently like a huge superstar in the wine world who started the video blog out of his family's wine retail business, and now he's got wine glasses with his name on them at Target, and is like and people were like eating it up, and the guy was like a Tony Robbins, you know, kind of guy. And the keynote speaker at the interactive was Nate Silver from 538.com, who's, you know, really one of the major, you know, political / cultural people in the last year in terms of just affecting the broader political culture and having a dialogue with the broader political culture. And then upstairs is my a friend I was having lunch with yesterday. Said, well, you've got, you know, some of the same old people from independent film doing kind of the same old panels. And I guess my thing is, how do you, and then the other comment I'll make, apologies to all, including myself, but the other thing I'll say is I think a lot of people, like if you go in the downstairs section, people who might have been 10 years ago interested in, you know, funding an independent film company, they're all investing in apps. Like, apps and widgets are like perceived as like the new growth model. So my, you know, the thing I'm thinking of is like, how do you marry the energy, how do you bring some of the energy of what's going on downstairs to the cultural production that should be going on upstairs? Because a lot of what is going on downstairs is really film, and which is perfectly great and fine, but it's like film as an educational medium, as an informational medium. It's, you know, film as brochure, film as community outreach, but it's not necessarily film as like a certain kind of culture production. And that, I mean, it's part of culture in the broader sense, but in terms of like, say, just pure art making, it's a different thing. And that's why, you know, when I go back and look at my whole life and things I've been interested in, involved with, it's not necessarily, you know, medium specific. It's the idea of creating certain types of artwork that exist slightly outside of mainstream culture and offer something different, you know, that mainstream culture doesn't offer. So, you know, at this, and the other thing that I've been thinking about, and this is something I've been thinking about for the last, you know, couple of years, but I really think American independent film is in a good place right now. I mean, I think that the work being produced is very, very, very strong.
Better than ever.
I think it's better than ever. And most of that work, the great majority of the work, is happening at the micro budget, at the very, very, very low budget level. And I do think that the model that I as a producer and other people embrace is sort of the more professional, quote-unquote, you know, true to whatever and up model, is not producing the strongest work, you know, within the field. And
because it's market-driven, partially.
Pardon me?
Partially because
that work is market-driven.
Right.
And the stuff that's happening at the smaller level is very artisanal, it's rippling out way beyond its budget in terms of critical acclaim and festival, but it's sort of, you know, nobody's really making any money, whether it's at the small level or the bigger level. So, you know, I'm kind of rambling a bit here, but I've wondered, and as you've written about this, Scott, you've written about this a lot on your blog, is, you know, why are some of the people that have come up in both new and young independent filmmakers and the established veteran independent filmmakers not looking to create other work that's formally influenced by what's going on in the downstairs in the interactive world? And Liz, you were talking about this a little bit earlier, is getting out of that 90-minute you know, feature film format, which, in addition to having certain storytelling rules built into it, also has certain business model, you know, assumptions and business models built into it.
There are some good examples mm-hmm. of people that are in the art film world.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I don't want to say that nobody is doing it, but I guess, you know, for me and sort of wearing my producer hat, I'm thinking like, how do I kind of get back to some of the things I both love to make and also love to view, and things that I really perceived that had huge value, and how do I use the energies going on downstairs to see those works created? And another thing I'm very, very interested in is how the business models of downstairs, the interactive world, and the delivery methods inform the audience's value of the work. And I think that, you know, I worry that there's a kind of, and this is, you know, certainly informed my position as a journalist, you know, I'm worried that there's a kind of devaluation of the audience's mind of work when it's delivered so easily. And, you know, this is something that all journalists are having, you know, are facing right now. And both whether the concept of the work is being devalued, whether the experience of watching in a browser window with all these little ads and pop-ups and stuff, whether that changes the concept of the work, and whether, you know, something I've been obsessed with on the filmmaker blog is like the Google book settlement, which is, you know, really like completely fascinating in terms of the history of like intellectual property. But, you know, it's pushing everything towards an ad model. And it's pushing, you know, and the guy at the panel, Scott, on your panel yesterday from Snag, he was basically saying, okay, the CPM is at a good part. Now it's all about streaming up. Well, what about work that will never get that huge number of people?
Yeah.
And the problem with the ad-supported CPM model is that it the person who is super passionate, who's like in love with something, they'll pay $100 to watch something. That person pays the same 2 cents as, you know, anybody else. And for work that can never get that huge audience, how do you create some method where the people who really want to support it, you know, passionately and you know, help in its creation or reward the creator and whatever. So
the other part of the, you know, 60,000, you know, views from that was that
sort of galley
in 2 months, Morgan said that he sold 69,000 DVDs.
Yeah.
You know, and if that, it's, and if, you know, there is
is those objects, and perhaps not just the $20 DVD, but the $100 fetish object that comes with X, Y, and Z. You know, maybe there is a model that allows the broadcast there.
No, I think there is. One thing I'll say is I very much am in the crowd that believes that physical media and objects are going away. So I, you know, whether it's sooner or later, I think it's sooner to medium. And I guess I'm not, you know, the people like Morgan are, you know, they made their living in traditional media. So he was launched by traditional media. So this is like the ripple effect of traditional media for him. And so the question is, someone who emerges completely from digital media, you know, from non-traditional media, how will that person make something? But also the other thing I want to say is I'm not speaking of value just in terms of dollars and cents thing. And, you know, like everybody else in the world, you know, I've been, you know, I picked up the copy of Lewis Hyde's The Gift, which I had never read before. It's been sitting on my bookshelf. And, you know, that book is all about, that book is about value.
It's a hard read, I think.
It's a book.
Yeah.
You know, but it's a book about how value accrues beyond an economic value, and how things that are given away are more valuable to the people. So anyway, these are all the things that are, you know, percolating in my head at the moment.
All right. So I want to wrap up really shortly and toss out kind of this thing that I've been thinking about a little bit pre-South By, which is that, if you think about the horrible straits that the publishing industry was in 10 or 15 years ago, and how Oprah has kind of buoyed at least a particular little segment of books that she chooses and turns into these giant bestsellers and gets people reading, you know, serious fiction and nonfiction and classics and new books, I kind of have been thinking about this idea of, well, what if there could be an Oprah's book club for film? And maybe not necessarily with a personality like Oprah at the center of it, but a more distributed thing where you could have house parties all around the country that were really about, can you get together a group of 5 or 10 or 15 people to watch a documentary, watch a narrative feature, and talk about it? And, you know, it is happening a little bit with individual films, right, where Robert Greenwald will do house parties, or, you know, he's created this thing, Brave New Theaters, where people can do it. But it hasn't yet attained the cultural movement of, if I think about Boston and how many different book clubs I could join, I mean, every bookstore has, you know, these lists of 25, 30, 40 book clubs just in their little part of Cambridge, for example.
Can I ask you, do you have a film club culture?
No.
We have one in the UK.
No, and yeah, the closest thing that I know of to a film club culture is, like, you know, the Landmark Theaters near me has a Sunday morning screening series.
Grassroots, like, film society, arts-oriented, community-based conversation going on in every city in America. I mean, I see that every day, and it's new. Like, I think that those communities are becoming more empowered to be on the cutting edge rather than, like, old grannies watching classics. But it's there. It's there.
I would say that it, you know, it may exist, but it's not attained the same cultural impact that Oprah's book club has, where, you know, you pick a film of the month to discuss.
It's
maybe it is, but you know, I would argue that it isn't yet something that's moving the needle for filmmakers, where you can say, like, all right, there are 1,000, you know, groups that have decided to watch my.
I've had this experience. I'm sure everyone at this table has had the experience of going to a dinner party where someone at some point says, oh, there was that thing on YouTube. Did you see that? And everyone goes to the computer and you watch that thing. And then somebody else is like, oh, but then there's that other thing. Yeah. And you go watch that other thing. And soon you've, like, been at a party where an hour and a half people have stared at YouTube, that where you know, people have performances of themselves, something they saw as a kid, some music video.
I should say that when they, you know, the 20-year-old kids in the office say, when they go to a party, instead of something on their iPod, people program the YouTube, the song off YouTube, and it's played through the stereo.
Yeah. So the question, Robert Greenwald has a business model that's sort of based on kind of what you just talked about, and there are, like, cinema clubs and stuff. The question is, you know, is the feature film format and the public's perception of the value of feature film and its relationship, particularly to a younger generation of people who are not wired the same way that many of us at this table are wired, is that, like, strong enough to resist the pull of these things that are happening much more organically and much more casually?
So this is going to translate really well for the podcast, but I've just been thinking about this chart, which is, you know, if you think about the filmmaker's career and sort of the filmmaker's aspiration, it's you start off making short films in film school, and your aspiration is to become Peter Jackson and make longer and longer movies at higher and higher cost. And that's what sort of status and success is about in the film world. But then if you think about what's been happening over the last 5 years with the audience, they've been watching shorter and shorter content that's made for lower and lower cost. So filmmakers here and everywhere can ignore that trend and say, we want to keep moving up the cost and length curve, and how do you deal with the fact that the audience wants to do what you're saying, which is hang around at a party or sit around a cubicle at an office and watch things in 3 minute clips.
And it goes one step further, I think, than just the shorter and shorter length. I swore I was going to stop doing this, using my 8-year-old son as like the barometer for
everything. That's why people
everything.
Have kids, right? Is to stay in touch with the zeitgeist.
But you know, it's curious. Like at one point in time, you know, he was talking about what he wanted to do, and he said he wanted to be a film designer. And I said, What do you mean? Like the guy that does the sets? And he goes, No. The movie, that's just the DVD. But what do you call the person that does that all, makes the trading cards and the action figures and all that sort of stuff? I said this, you know, like what the point to me was, like there was no consumer term for transmedia. There was not that allowed people to say what he wants. When he says Pokemon, he means all of Pokemon, right? And like right now, you know, he describes himself as like a Lego kid, which means that what he's doing, his main thing is he's doing minifigs that he then uses Sculpty to make different character. He makes yokai heads is what his current thing is, and he's made 60 of these so far, and he's excited to exhibit because he sees the community Brothers Brick of Lego people who do kind of similar things, and he wants to be part of that community. At the same time that the length is going down, I think the desire for a richer participation in everything is going up at the same time. And it feels like culturally, in terms of movies, like for a long time people define themselves, say, in rock and roll. You can say, oh, I'm into emo and free jazz, and that's part of their cultural identity. But in film, we're only at the most broadest subject. I'm a horror freak. I'm a Star Wars fan. Oh, I like art film. It's nowhere near the definition that allows me. Nor is there a good way to organize people in that same thing. Like to me, it's common sense that as a filmmaker now, you would build the book reading questions, the book group questions for your movie, particularly if you're making art film, and people still don't do that. Like, you know, you've been saying that, people have been saying that for 2 years, but yet a filmmaker comes in, and I talk to them about it in an early stage, and it still isn't on their radar. All of the things that recognizing that as a filmmaker, you have the responsibility to give that richer, more complex, you know, community experience is right now not part of the equation.
Sorry, I'm just going to say I'm unfortunately got a session now. It's great.
Okay. And Liz, can you say for the record that Liz skipped out on a check?
Liz is leaving without paying. No, I'm kidding. Liz paid.
When are you? Are you all leaving today?
Well, I have a meeting there.
Yeah, I'll see you later. Hopefully, see you later. You're around tomorrow.
No, I'm taking off this afternoon.
All right. Thank you. Nice to meet you, Ted. Thank you.
I wanted to address your film club thing because I think there's a way that could be done decentralized, and there's a huge, you know, obviously a huge blogging audience that's already out there, you know, and making use of finding a way to work in conjunction with people who are blogging already and bringing them into some, I mean, it happens, but having some kind of general to kickstart it, you know, like the way you talk about Cambridge and all these bookstores do it. So I think it's a matter of just like a decentralized approach would work very well, and then would move towards the numbers of something like Oprah or whatever.
I was going to say, so do you think, I mean, I know certain films, Caitlin's right, that certain films have a great house party strategy, but I just don't think that there's a general cultural awareness where if you said to someone sitting at the next table in the restaurant, do you know about book clubs? Like, do you know anyone who belongs to a book club? They would say yes. And if you said, is there such a thing as a film club where people get together to watch films or talk about films?
There's hundreds of them. I mean, I think that actually does really exist. I mean, I think think that it is decentralized. I think it is grassroots. I don't think that there's a spokesperson like Oprah for the film club. I don't think there's someone who's creating sort of a great books curriculum for film clubs to then tap into. And maybe that's further down the line, but I do really think that that's happening all across the country. And Canada, I have to say, Canada has a million film clubs, and I get so many calls from Canadians. BCers, they are just all over film clubs.
But then again, Canada, you know, has like film circuits.
Exactly.
Things that really promote that.
It does.
Like what Scott was saying, like this year, there were, and I believe, at least 15 great under $1 million movies. Where previously, in my experience, maybe it's a question of exposure, but I go to the festivals, it was around 2 to 3. You know, and so there was 15. And these films are being seen less and less. And yet, you know, every time you talk to a filmmaker, they say when there is a organized, not-for-profit community, they have their best audience, then any amount of outreach they're able to do, because they can't lock in to where those communities are yet.
And everyone's tried to attack it in a different way, right? They've tried to say, like, all right, we're going to have a subscription thing that you can buy, and you're going to get once a month, you'll get the great
film movie,
undiscovered, right.
Well,
or what people have tried is saying, okay, there are these groups, whether it's church groups or political groups, and, you know, trying to reach those people in non-traditional distribution. But, like, I just don't think there's a central database or central repository where you could say, you know, like, let me search for all the groups that are interested in documentary films or interested in art film or interested in science fiction film.
I'm not a fan of central databases, but I think, the central database is the internet, you know, and it's the decentralized central database. But I think
it's a new model completely.
Yeah, I think what you guys are getting at is this question of, like, I think we have an unhealthy, whatever this group of people, the fans, the audience, the consumers, the viewers, the users, whoever they are, which maybe we need a better name for that, but or just people or something. The community, sure. The community has certain habits, right? And I think we have a not so healthy relationship with these habits. And I think we don't realize how fast these habits can change. For example, for years and years, there was this habit that people would pay for music by buying a record, a tape, a CD, whatever, right? And that habit is gone. Right, and I think a lot of people say, "Well, nobody will ever pay for music now, and it's over, and we killed it, and it's gone." Yet, for centuries, thousands, you know, throughout history, nobody would ever pay for water, and one day, a couple of companies came along and said, "Okay, now you're paying for water, and there's a $5 bottle of water in my hotel room that somebody will buy." Okay, so there's this. You know, and I think, like, another example is like Bill Gates. You know, he was like, it was the beginning, the dawn of the PC era, and people were all sort of trading software, and he like publishes this kind of letter to the editor thing that says, from now on, we will all pay for software, and it will come in a box. And for 25 years, people did that, just because he wrote this letter. So I think I'd like to learn more about that kind of relationship between habits that are, like, why do people, just why does, like, the community all of a sudden one day just kind of say we're this habit is over, we all have this new habit, and why does sometimes, you know, some innovator can they say okay, I'm going to dictate to you this new habit or teach you this new habit? Like, how do we find a healthy relationship where we say we're going to make this available to you, educate you about it, without kind of being oppressive at it?
Yeah, so I mean, I think of that as, like, in the book, I talk about that as sort of paying attention to behavioral shifts. And a behavioral shift is, hey, the audience suddenly is watching 3-minute videos, lots of them, and they don't care about production values anymore. The thing that worries me most, and that, like, I haven't slept since I saw Brett's film, Rip or Remix Manifesto, is that, you know, can you put up toll gates anymore and actually charge people for content in a world where it's all digital and it's very free-flowing and there's torrent sites? Or do you just have to, you know, are we going to all be buskers on the street corner with our hat out saying, I'm giving you my stuff for free and I hope that you'll give me some money in return for it? You know what I mean?
Because that's what I do like all day, and people do pay for movies, and there is a value, and communities are hungry for that programming. It's unbelievable. It shocks me every day the number of people who come forward and say, I want this film, how do I get permission to show it, how much do I pay, where does the check go, and the check comes the next day. So people are paying for that content.
We're talking more about individual consumers of the type that are, you know, let's say they're under 25.
That's who I'm, but that's who I'm talking to. I mean, it's not just like old grannies. It's people of all ages. I'm 27. Most of the people that I work with are my age. But it's not an either or. It's not a zero sum game. There's some free stuff. There's some short format stuff. There's YouTube, you know, screen watching at parties. But there's also this old fashioned conventional world that's getting slowly, that's getting molded into this new
system.
I think that we need to, I like to kind of adopt a habit of trying to find ways to be more constructive. Who was that guy that at the LA Film Festival? He said, "The sky is falling." I forget his name. I don't know him.
Mark Gill.
So Mark Gill, he gets up there and he's like, there are too many films. We need to have fewer films. And I'm like, that is not good for the world to say, like, you know what? You can't make a feature film on this digital camera. No, I want kids everywhere throughout the world and old people, you know, to make that, do that. That is good for everybody, you know? And I want to see how can we kind of align these social goods with the kind of selfish part of it, with the profit. And I say, let's not try to build, you know, toll gates. You know, I say take down the toll gate, but instead I'm going to sell you a faster engine. You know, something that is like really kind of pushing more positive. Like, let's not say, okay, how can I withhold my movie from you and lock you down? Let's say, how can I add a new social experience? How can I bring in Larry Lessig to start a fight?
And here is that, like, maybe the future is all in software and widgets, and maybe the future is, like, if you want to get really rich, you have to build YouTube, you know, which is this content distribution.
But those details, that's the thing, is those details, you know, are going to change. Historically, they've changed every generation, but now they're going to change every year and a half, you know?
YouTube in a film?
The details. I mean, because it is this question of sort of addressing the core underlying issues, and then it's like we need to partner with the technologists to figure out those business models, and there can't be just one. You know, it's going to change every 2 years, and I think, like, the approach of Creative Commons was like, we're going to address just this legal part of the question, you know, and I think we need to rely on a lot of different people to come up with business model solutions, but it's good that, you know, filmmakers are talking about what they need and what they want to see. But, you know, this is Lessig's whole thing, is with the hybrid economy. There's some things that are paid for, some things that are free. And he always talks about Flickr, you know, like most people use Flickr for free. However, there is like a freemium business model that's added on to that. We need to figure out what that is for us and make sure, you know, and we had this conversation last night was, you know, we would rather a million people download it without feeling guilty about it and sell, you know, 30,000 DVDs, then 3,000 people feel like they're stealing it and we only sell 10,000 DVDs. Do you know what I mean?
Although, yeah. Why are those things in opposition?
Because if you could
have people downloading a lot and sell
3,000. Right. Exactly.
Or the opposite, too.
Because
you could also have a few people download and a lot of DVDs.
But not unless we embrace the free. Not unless we say, we know this is going on, we will not sue you, everything is okay. However, we have given you a really easy mechanism for you to support the artist.
Help us.
Well, I was going to let you have the last word, and then we'll stop recording and have a normal human conversation.
I was just going to say, a lot of it, you know, obviously comes down to the consumption of the media, the behavior, right? And if we look at it, one of the inevitable things that's happening is people can do all this themselves anyway. You know, so like the sooner that we realize, like as Scott mentioned, going to a dinner party and everybody gets up and they go and they look at YouTube, the fact that it's shifting so much is opportunity there. And when there was a comment about, okay, well, maybe here at South by Southwest, the interactive side seems like it's booming in some way, and it has been for a number of years. You can go and you can look, and some of that came out of the VC side and the investment in it. And you know, it's left to be determined what happens exactly with the interactive side. it's interesting, but there's innovation in that side that's very similar, except, you know, it's channeled where anybody who wanted to kind of create a site, a service, whatever, whatever goofy name they wanted to give it to, they would, and they put together a business plan, and they put it in front of somebody, and somebody would give them capital for it. Maybe, maybe not. There was a time where, it was very fluid. And I think what happens with media is that people are locked into the forms that we've talked about. And I think really it's just turning on that engine of that interaction with that individual. Because if you have these two market forces, you have the one where everybody's creating whatever they want to create anyway. And then on the other side, you have like the accessibility to that. It's like, okay, how do we really ignite that? How do we ignite that innovation? And I think some of the development really does need to come from R&D. Like if you mention something like an infrastructure build, or you mention something like apps and widgets or whatever it is, you know, there's fundamental parts of the process where there's tons of friction. But it's like, and I've said this before, there are so many people who have much more audience, you know, who make more money than independent filmmakers, you know, people who spend time and they have YouTube channels or something, and they're able to monetize those. And I know that you cover that in the book, Scott, you know, but that kind of thing is like inevitable, you know. So whether you look at the piracy and you say, okay, well, that's inevitable, you know, all these things start to chip down at it. And it's like, okay, well, it's really about the practicality of, yes, everybody experiments, but, you know, what are the experiments? You know, how do we go forward from here? How do we move from theoretical? What is actually working? You know, how do we put together those business plans that we envy of the interactive that fill 1,000 people in a room? Like the core that